a baby koala about 6 months old.
I wonder if we could get a closer look at the koala. I'd love to hold it.
Koalas in the bad old days were shot for their skins. There's no sport in shooting them, of course, because they're slow-moving things, they're inoffensive, and they're just a sitting shot in a tree. It's just cold-blooded murder, made all the worse by the fact that a wounded koala makes a pitiable cry for all the world like the sound of a baby crying. But they did shoot them, and soon they became rare. Koalas here were on the verge of extinction.
According to a new report, thousands of hectares of koala habitat has been
virtually koalas in the section
of the koala population.
Most important koala habitat.
Tokyo's Narita Airport for the arrival of six koala bears.
The koalas are not affected.
I know it all sounds too good to be true, but I have a movie film to prove it, and perhaps when we have television in Australia, which won't be very long now, we're promised, I may show that film as a guarantee of good faith.
Anne Jones with you, and this is Off Track, the ABC's very own nature program, where you can hear all about the most weird and wonderful parts of Australia every single week. And this week, the wonderfully popular koala. Topping the scale at a muscular 7 or so kilograms, this is a really big animal. And if you look at where the map as to where koalas are meant to occur in Australia, it stretches in a big patch along the east coast. And some populations, like, say, that on the northern New South Wales and southern Queensland coastal area, or maybe the translocated population of koalas on Kangaroo Island, they get a lot of press. And it's often to do with numbers. Either there's too many or lamentably few. But what about the other shaded-in bits of the map of koala occupancy of this continent? Say, through the highlands of New South Wales, in the hills around Glen Innes. Are there koalas there?
The area we've come to is mapped as old growth, and there are lots of different ways that people describe what old growth is, but really it's characterised by trees that are hundreds of years old, so they're full of hollows.
Dr. Brad Law is an ecologist, and he works for the Forest Science Unit within the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, and he's trying to find koalas.
Spotlighting is one of the common techniques that are used, and so these northeast forests that we're working in, a really large-scale study was done in the 1990s, and well, close to 200 sites were surveyed, and koalas were only detected on about 5% of sites using spotlighting. So I think that's really one of the big reasons why people think a lot of these forests are unoccupied by koalas.
What are you hoping to achieve with this study?
Well, two main aims. One is to look at the status of koalas across the northeast forests. How many different forests are occupied by koalas. And the other one is, how is their level of occupancy responding to different levels of timber harvest and time since harvest. So we want to look at the effects of logging on koalas.
But that means you've got to find koalas in the forest. And it's harder than you might think, given they're a big animal.
You would think they would be easy. Yeah, you would. But they're not, especially in taller forests. So that's one thing, maybe coastal forests near where a lot of people live, people do see them, but out in more remote areas, like all the forests we've got along our Great Dividing Range, they could be sitting up in the treetops, but more often than not during the day, they're probably in the understory, just, you know, got a nice little safe spot to sit and shelter, and they're surprisingly difficult to see.
Ah, oh, cool. koalas with those cute and fluffy ears and the slumpy dumpy posture and that hard little teddy bear nose. But we're not here for a photo opportunity. Rather, we're on our way down a gully to put in place a song meter. That's a long-term sound recorder. Though I'm not exactly sure that the sound that koalas make comes across quite like a song.
That's right. If you're out in the forest at night and you hear that sound, the last thing you think of is a cute little animal, that little furry thing that people like to cuddle.
Has it always been koalas with you?
No, I'm a fairly recently have come to koalas, just in the last couple of years. But for many years, I've worked on microbats, little insectivorous echolocating bats. And I still do. They're a fantastic group, but very different to koalas.
Yeah. However, you are doing this koala study. How did it come about?
I think for me it was a bit of a natural extension, because the way we work on bats is we record their echolocating sounds that people can't hear, but they're forever calling as they're flying around. So we use special equipment to record those sounds, and we can identify different species and what they're doing. But also a couple of times that I was just camping in the forest with my family on a holiday and overnight just hearing koalas bellowing all through the night. And I think at some point it kind of twigged for me that during the breeding season, male koalas call a lot, and that could be used to survey for them.
A leech.
I thought that might be a bit leechy here.
Yeah, it does seem a little bit leechy.
Yeah,
thought I felt one before.
Yep, there's one on your leg.
And halfway down the valley, in the right sort of forest.
Yeah, okay, got it.
Get off.
There we go.
Brad and his colleague Tracy strap a little box onto a tree, and it's got a microphone sticking out.
Hey, it's going to sleep. So it'll wake back up at dusk, and we record through the night. So it's all set.
So this project isn't about spotting koalas, it's about hearing them.
And Tracy bringing starter sheet.
So have you actually, while you've been putting out within this koala survey, actually spotted any koalas yet?
No.
I have a couple of times.
But you have.
But like two times. We're up to about 160 sites, and maybe twice.
But how many have you actually found that koalas are present?
About 80% of sites, it is.
Was that a surprise?
It was a big surprise. I felt pretty confident the method would work, but I thought maybe we might just get a few extra sites. But we're getting, you know, 8-10 times higher levels of occupancy. Really, the koalas spend a lot of their day asleep because they live on a very tough diet. They're a specialist eucalypt foliage feeder. They're really the only one and greater gliders that can do that. And they're very difficult leaves to digest. So they've got the longest cecum of any animal in the world, and it's like a big fermentation chamber. So that what they need to do is eat those leaves and let it ferment, get those handful of nutrients out of it. So they've got to live a very low active, slow lifestyle. But it's a bit of a different story at night.
So what happens at night?
Well, they are much more active at night. And particularly during the breeding season, the males will move over quite big areas and they will call. They've got a very loud, pig-like grunting call, which the females find very attractive.
And at dusk, long after we've left the area, that little recorder flicks an automatic switch and records 12 hours straight of audio. The insects start to call as the forest cools down. Birds start their dusk chorus, which is a gentler version of their dawn chorus. It's haunting and echoing through this patch of old growth just outside Glen Innes in northern New South Wales. The wind rises. There's a white-throated nightjar in the distance. and at some point, it starts to rain. The recorder picks all of that up and files it away.
There's a whole variety of species that we've recorded while it's been out there. And we're focused on getting those koala calls, but there are all sorts of things that live in the forest and call at night as well. There's some other spectacular calls we've recorded, like the sooty owl. So they've got some amazing calls that they make.
Terrifying in its own way, isn't it?
Yeah, owl calls have got a reputation for being quite terrifying. And then yellow belly glider.
And even the almost gull-like call of the tiny owlet nightjar. And yet, these aren't the sounds that Dr. Brad Law from the Department of Primary Industries is looking for.
Particularly the male koala in spring, they're on the hunt for females, and so they're quite territorial, and the way they advertise themselves is to produce this very loud call, which most people call a bellow.
Are they strictly speaking nocturnal?
Not strictly speaking, no. And you can hear koalas bellowing at any time of the day, any time of the year, but there's definite peaks. And so spring is a peak, and also the other thing we found out from our work is that midnight is a bit of a peak. You might be out here early in the evening, and you can hear a koala at that time of day, but the middle of the night, it's much more common. The male's got two real aims, I think, with his call. One is to advertise himself to other females in the forest, but also to advertise himself to other males. So if he's a big male, he wants to commandeer what females are in that area. Mm-hmm. And he can do that through his call.
Thank you. A koala is here. Bradlaugh, along with academics from the Queensland University of Technology, have worked out how to make a computer listen to these 12-hour-long recordings and then pick out the koala calls.
Koalas have got a very distinctive call. So it's a low-frequency call. It sounds like a pig grunting or something like that, and it's a repeating pattern of low-frequency sounds, and that's what the computer can search for as it's scanning all those recordings.
Yeah, so it essentially puts it through an algorithm that picks out these frequencies and says this is a possible koala.
That's right.
So do you then have to verify that it is indeed, rather than thunder or something else that's low?
Yeah, yep, computers aren't perfect by any means, so we get a lot of false positives, and they can be thunder, or it can be trucks rumbling in the distance. Sometimes planes flying overhead, so even though we're in a remote forest, there are still lots of planes, and every computer match of a koala call, we check just to make sure it is a koala. There's a grunt and then there's a snort. This, I think, is the snort. That's the inhalation, and then the other is. And so they've got actually a special larynx that allows them to reverberate and get that low frequency. It can sound like a lion roaring. It's a loud call and has an impact.
Far out. So when did you put out your first set of traps?
2015, so about 3 years ago.
And what was it like the first time that you actually heard a koala back?
To get the recordings was really exciting, yeah. So we were trying something new at that point, and we're collaborating with Queensland University of Technology. They're processing all the koala calls, all the recordings that we make. But to get those recordings and to see how many sites we were recording koalas on was really something. Yeah, that was... were very unexpected, really.
How has this technology and your findings changed the common understanding of where koalas are?
Yeah, well, we're still not quite finished our project yet, but I think it will change the way people perceive these forests along the Great Dividing Range in northeast New South Wales, so that's where we're focused on. Because at the moment, it's not really thought of as being an important area for koalas. But if we're finding about 80% of the sites that we're surveying have got koalas, that should really change the way it's thought of and their importance. And it's not just small pockets, it's widespread across a really big area. Koalas are going to occur at low density. So even though we might have recorded koalas being present in an area, you probably wouldn't expect there to be a huge variation in numbers of how many are in that area. So occupancy is really quite relevant for a low density animal.
What is the conservation status of the koala in New South Wales?
Yeah, they're listed as an endangered species, so vulnerable is their classification, and also at the federal level as well, except for Victoria.
So the occupancy, as in the green tick, there's koalas here, how will that change the management of these forests?
So the forests are managed in different ways. We're surveying both state forests and national parks, and the state forests that we're surveying are obviously used for harvesting of timber, and there are a range of prescriptions already in place to protect koalas, but at the same time allow harvesting of the timber. But at the moment, there's a requirement for people to go out and survey prior to areas being harvested to look for koalas, and they're very hard to find. And if you do find them, that can trigger further protection. But if you're not finding them, then that extra protection's not being triggered.
Bradlaugh says that so far they have equal detection rates in national parks and state forest, and the detection rates are, he says, still high after timber harvesting. Though this is no gauge of koala health or well-being. It's just presence. They're there and they persist. There's still a long way to go before the forest tells us all its secrets. And eventually, dawn will arrive. I'm Ann Jones, and if you've got grumpy koalas or possums, frogs, birds or insects that you hear and you've got your phone on you, I'd love for you to record it and send it to me. My email address is offtrack@abc.net.au. It's really easy to do, and I love to use your recordings in this program, offtrack@abc.net.au. Now it's time to make like a koala and have a snooze, well, for me anyway. This is Off Track, and be sure to meet me right here at the same time next time. That's when I'll take you somewhere else.